Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Zechariah chapter 9, which I will call Judgment on Zion's Enemies, the Coming of Zion's King. A little bit of introduction before we start. Chapter 9 is written sometime after the temple was completed in 516. The first eight chapters of our book mainly dealt with the short-term restoration of Israel, the rebuilding of the temple, which occurred between 520 and 516. And then there were some projections forward into the so-called Golden Age between circa 458 and 168 as the nation of Israel was rebuilt all the way up to the times of the Maccabees and up to the times of Antiochus the Epiphanes. Now, in these eight chapters, there were scattered mystical references to the Messiah. And of course, usually the commentators split. Is this a reference to the Messiah or not? But now, as we go to chapters 9 through 14, we are dealing mainly with the long-term restoration of Israel in the Messianic Age of the New Covenant. At least that's the way preterists take it, and I'm a preterist. Futurists say it's the Millennial Kingdom, but I don't believe in a Millennial Kingdom, so I'm going to take it this way, that chapters 9 through 14 are talking about the arrival of Jesus and the New Covenant Age. Now, chapter 8 is a good transition from the Golden Age to the Messianic Age, the Golden Age being between 458 and 168. Here's an example verse from the last chapter, Zechariah 8, verse 12, "For they will sow in peace. The vine will yield its fruit, the land will yield its produce, and the skies will yield their dew. I will give the remnant of this people all these things as an inheritance." Now, all of these events, starting in chapter 9 all the way through verse 14, occur after the restoration of the temple, as I said earlier, but they occur before the first coming of Jesus the Messiah. Now, these events can be seen as a type of the coming of the New Covenant Kingdom. However, some people see the events as predicting the New Covenant Church directly by skipping the type. I really don't think it matters that much. The point is the Kingdom of Christ is coming. So we begin now in Zechariah 9, verse 1. "The burden of the word of the Lord is against the land of Hadrach, with Damascus as its resting place, for the eyes of men, especially of all the tribes of Israel, are toward the Lord." The burden of the word of the Lord, that word burden is commonly translated as oracle. That translation, as Joyce Baldwin, quoting a DeBoer, puts it, lays stress on the prophet's sense of constraint in giving the message that follows. He would not have chosen to give it, but he finds he has no option. It has been placed on him, and like the load bearer, he has to accept it and discharge his duty. Like an ambassador, he is given his message, and however unacceptable it may be, he cannot alter it, hence the burdensome aspect of his calling. Now this oracle of Yahweh is against the land of Hadrach. Zechariah has already told us the Lord had sent him against the pagan nations in chapter 2, verse 8. "For thus says the Lord of hosts, after glory," in other words, for the purpose of glory, "he has sent me against the nations which plunder you. For he who touches you touches the apple of his eye." So God has sent Zechariah against the nations which plunder the Israelites, is one interpretation of that verse. So the reason that Yahweh is preaching against the nations and Zechariah is bringing this word against the nations is because the nations have not been kind to Israel. The nations have plundered or helped to plunder the Israelites. The first nation that is mentioned is Damascus, the land of Hadrach, with Damascus as its resting place. Hadrach is mentioned only here in the Old Testament. Dictionary.com says that Hadrach is the name of a town and country in Aram, which is Syria, mentioned only once in the Bible here at Zechariah 9:1. It is heard of for the first time in the inscription of Zachar, king of Hamath, circa 800 B.C., and then reappears in the Assyrian documents of the 8th century B.C., which mention a satrapy called Hatarika. In 738 B.C., it was conquered by Tiglath-Pileser III. Its exact location is not known. Now, when was Hadrach judged? As Guzik says, most commentators see the judgment of Hadrach coming through Alexander the Great. Now, where is this Hadrach? Well, Atlas.org has Hadrach as being the same town as Damascus. It's somewhere in Syria. The oracle of the Lord is against the land of Hadrach with Damascus as its resting place. Sounds like the oracle is going out after Hadrach and ends up at Damascus, which makes it sound like Hadrach and Damascus are awful close, if not the same place. Now, where is Damascus? Well, everybody knows where the Sea of Galilee is. If you go about 10 or 15 miles north of the Sea of Galilee, you reach the little tiny Lake Hula. Go about 15 miles north of that, and you hit Caesarea Philippi, where Jesus told Peter to get behind him, Satan. Caesarea Philippi is, of course, the modern-day Benaiah. Old name was Panaiah, right at the foot of Mount Hermon, the source of the eastern source of the Jordan River. There's a cave there, and a bunch of people who are into the Blurry Creatures podcast and Michael Heiser's Unseen Realm, and people are into weird stuff, the Sons of God, Watcher Angels, and all this stuff. They say there's a portal to hell right there at Mount Hermon. And that cave there at Caesarea Philippi, which I've seen, and it's still full of pagan idols, is how the demons come from below the earth to get into the world. Now, I don't know what I think about all that. I decided to quit listening to the Blurry Creatures podcast so that I would have time to do this pretty good Bible studies podcast. Well, at Caesarea Philippi, if you go about 70 miles northeast, you will hit Damascus. So Damascus is fairly close to Israel. Well, when was Damascus, or Hadrach, judged? Most commentators say it's when Alexander the Great came through. Alexander the Great started his famous campaign for Macedonia in 334, and on that campaign, he destroyed Damascus on his way east, as Fred Miller says. However, Adam Clark says Damascus was not really destroyed, it was merely betrayed without the shedding of blood. It was plundered of its treasure, but it wasn't destroyed. That's a quibble. Most scholars say the fulfillment is with Alexander the Great. Lee Smith also raises an objection. Damascus wasn't judged like Tyre, so there's a problem there. No, if it got beat and it got plundered, that's bad enough. Some people say, actually, that this is not a prophecy to destroy Damascus. Rather, it's that Damascus would be converted to belief in Yahweh. So the oracle is against Hadrach and Damascus in the sense that they're not believers, but then they will be. I don't believe that. I believe they got destroyed by Alexander the Great. And we'll see as we go through this chapter that much of it is fulfilled. Much of the chapter is fulfilled by Alexander the Great. Adam Clark says that this chapter refers to the times of Jeremiah and Nebuchadnezzar, which of course is before Zechariah. That would make Zechariah an historian, not a prophet. So I don't believe that. Now the oracle is said to rest on Damascus, to have Damascus as its resting place. Why Damascus? Well, Damascus had been a very unpleasant neighbor to the Israelites. Syria in general, not just Damascus. Damascus is the capital, but Syria had been a very bad neighbor. And so God's going to judge them. And so he used Alexander the Great to judge them. Now, in verse 1, the eyes of men, especially of all the tribes of Israel, are toward the Lord. What does that mean? Here are three options. Option number one, the eyes are toward the Lord in the sense that men are looking at the instrument of God's vengeance, namely Alexander the Great, who is the instrument of God's vengeance. That's Guzik's option. Option number two, the eyes of men are toward the Lord, looking at the Lord in consternation as Alexander the Great makes his march. Now, of course, that would refer to the people not in Israel. The verse says that the eyes of all men, especially of the tribes of Israel, so it's the people in Israel looking at the Lord, and also the eyes of people not in Israel looking at the Lord. Matthew Henry says it's God's people looking to God in prayer. Well, that takes care of the people in Israel, but what about the people not in Israel? I think it refers to everybody looking at what's happening to Damascus, what's happening to Syria. They're looking at God. We go down to Zechariah 9, verses 2 through 4. And Hamath also, which borders on it, which borders on Damascus, Tyre and Sidon, though they are very wise. For Tyre built herself a fortress and piled up silver like dust and gold like the mire of the streets. Behold, the Lord will dispossess her and cast her wealth into the sea, and she will be consumed with fire. Well, if you look at the map, Damascus is east of the southern tip of the Anti-Lebanon Range where Mount Hermon is. And if you go about 70 or 80 miles due north, right in the middle of the Orontes River, which starts right between the Lebanon and Anti-Lebanon ranges and runs north right through Hamath, and then it keeps running north, and then all of a sudden takes a sharp hook to the west and dumps into the Mediterranean Sea. Well, that's Hamath, very famous place, mentioned many times in the scripture. And verse 2 says, and Hamath also, what does that mean? It means the burden or oracle of the word of the Lord is not only against Damascus, it's against Hamath. Not only against Hadrach and Damascus, but also Hamath. And also Tyre and Sidon, the famous cities on the Mediterranean coast, north of Israel, in present-day Lebanon, in ancient Phoenicia. Now, Tyre is an interesting place. It had been destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. I forgot the exact dates, but he destroyed the old city, and after he left, the Tyrians rebuilt their city, but this time they built offshore on an island using the rubble of the destroyed old city. That island was a small outcropping about a mile in the sea, and they put walls that were around 150 feet high above the waterline. So the new city of Tyre should have been impregnable. But when Alexander the Great showed up in November of 333, he at first failed in his sea assault to breach the walls. He then set his men to work gathering the remaining rubble of the old city. He cast that rubble into the sea to make a causeway from the shore to the new city of Tyre, the island city of Tyre, and he took it. Now, why did God want to judge Tyre? Because it was an evil city. Tyre said in their hearts they were God, and they sold Jews into slavery. We read that in various Old Testament scriptures, such as Isaiah 23, verses 8 through 9. Who planned this against Tyre, the bestower of crowns, whose traders are princes, whose merchants are the honored ones of the earth? The Lord of hosts planned it, to desecrate all its glorious beauty, to disgrace all the honored ones of the earth. Ezekiel 28, verses 6 through 9. Therefore, this is what the Lord God says, because you regard your heart as that of a god, I am about to bring strangers against you, ruthless men from the nations. They will draw their swords against your magnificent wisdom and will defile your splendor. They will bring you down to the pit, and you will die a violent death in the heart of the sea. Will you still say, I am a god in the presence of those who kill you? This is talking about Alexander the Great coming in and visiting a violent death in the heart of the sea on the Tyrians. Will you say, I am a god in the presence of those who kill you? Yet you will be only a man, not a god in the hands of those who kill you. Joel 3, verse 4. And also, Tyre, Sidon, and all the territories of Philistia, what are you to me? What are you to Yahweh? Are you paying me back? Are you paying me, Yahweh, back, or trying to get even with me? I will quickly bring retribution on your heads. 2 verses later in Joel 3, verse 6, you sold the people of Judah and Jerusalem to the Greeks to remove them far from their own territory. In other words, the people of Tyre were slave traders, and they would take Jewish captives and then sell them all over the West, all over the Mediterranean world. Tyre is called wise in verse 2. Tyre's wisdom consisted in piling up wealth and building a stronghold. Tyre, in verse 3, piled up silver like dust and gold like clay in the streets, mud in the streets. Tyre was renowned for its prosperity. However, after Alexander the Great conquered it in 333-332, Tyre never regained its wealth. In verse 4, Zechariah predicts the Lord will dispossess Tyre and cast her wealth into the sea, and that's exactly what happened. Alexander sank all of Tyre's ships before the city walls, and so all of her wealth was cast into the sea, and she will be consumed with fire. Tyre was burnt down by Alexander the Great. Alexander destroyed half the city after a seven-month siege. Let me read you from thecollector.com. Tyre was burned to the ground, and the attack is said to have cost approximately 8,000 Tyrians their lives. About 2,000 adult men survived the battle, but were crucified on Alexander's orders. Bye-bye, Tyre. Well, Alexander moved on south down the coast. He's next going to conquer the Philistine cities on the coast, Ashdod, Ashkelon, and Gaza, as well as a couple of cities inland a little bit from these three Philistine cities, Ekron. Gath is not mentioned. So in verse 5, we see Ashkelon will see the conquest of Tyre and be afraid, because they're next. Gaza, too, will writhe in great pain. Gaza is south of Ashkelon, so bad news. Ekron is inland from Ashdod, about 20 miles. She's going to be frightened, too, as Alexander comes. Moreover, the king will perish from Gaza. That's about 15 or 20 miles south of Ashkelon, where the big war is going on now, between Israel and Hamas. I'm recording on December the 12th, 2023. Ashkelon will not be inhabited. That's because Alexander the Great's going to take care of Ashkelon. We go to Zechariah 9, verse 6. And a mongrel race will dwell in Ashdod, and I will cut off the pride of the Philistines.
Now, verse 6 says that a mongrel race will dwell in Ashdod in the NASB. The King James translates it this way, and a bastard will dwell in Ashdod. Now, that translation leaves us the possibility that it's Alexander the Great who is being referred to here. Clark and Gill take it that way. They point out that Alexander the Great told everybody that he was not the son of his alleged father, Philip of Macedon, but he was the son of Jupiter Ammon, so he was an illegitimate son, a bastard son of Philip. Well, I don't think so. I think mongrel race is probably the better translation. Well, what is this mongrel race? Lee Smith, the contemporary commentator, says it's a mongrel race of Ashdodites and Jews. We read in the next century after Zechariah, sometime middle of the 5th century B.C., we read in Nehemiah 13, verses 23 through 24, "In those days I also saw that the Jews had married women from Ashdod, Ammon and Moab also. As for their children, half spoke in the language of Ashdod, and none of them was able to speak the language of Judah, but the language of his own people." Now, one might think that means the children spoke a patois, a combined language of Ashdodite and Hebrew. But Adam Clark says, no, that's probably not true. This is what he says. "They were children of the same family by Jewish and Philistine mothers." In other words, a man would marry a Jewish woman, have a kid by her, then he would marry a Philistine woman and have a kid by her. So the Jewish and Ashdodite kids were half brothers or half sisters. "As the Jewish mother would always speak to her children in Hebrew or Chaldee, Babylonian, so they learned to speak these languages. And as the Ashdod mother would always speak to her children in the Ashdod language, so they learnt that tongue. Thus there were, in the same family, children who could not understand each other, half or one part speaking one language and the other part another. Children of different wives did not ordinarily mingle together, and the wives had separate apartments. This is a better explanation than that which intimates that the same child spoke a jargon, half Ashdod and half Hebrew." Now, if that's the proper interpretation, mongrel race, then this means that Ashdod is losing its cultural identity. Now, at the end of verse 6, Yahweh says, "I will cut off the pride of the Philistines." Cutting off their pride might mean that they had become mongrelized. That's one option. Or it might be that the Maccabees later on, in the period between 160 and 134, when they gained ascendancy over Judea, during that time they destroyed the city of Ashdod. So let's take the option that Ashdod had its pride cut off because it had become mongrelized. This is held by Barnes, who says, "Pride would survive the ruin of their country, the capture of their cities, the loss of independence. It would not survive the loss of their nationality, for they themselves would not be the same people who were proud of their long descent and their victories over Israel. The breaking down of nationalities, which was the policy of Alexander, was an instrument in God's hands in cutting off their pride." Sort of like the nations of Europe now are losing their national identity because of the massive influx of refugees and exiles from the Middle Eastern Muslim countries. There's a reaction against it now in Italy and in the Netherlands, and in Hungary, and now in Sweden also. There's a big reaction against it, but it's probably too late. They've probably lost their natural identity in Europe, in my humble opinion, and nation states don't like that. This is what happened to Ashdod, according to that theory. Now, if the pride of the Ashdodites was cut off physically by the Maccabees, who destroyed their city, that opinion is held by Benson, who says this, "Ashdod, or Azotus, another name for Ashdod, was burned and destroyed by Jonathan, brother of Judas Maccabeus, and 8,000 of its men burned or slain." We can read about that in 1 Maccabees 10, verses 84 through 85. Well, I think it's probably meant to be said here in Zechariah 9, 6 that Ashdod was actually destroyed, as prophesied by Zechariah. He's prophesying what's happening to the cities on the Mediterranean coast as Alexander the Great comes from the west down the coast on his way to Egypt. Or it could be on his way back from Egypt. I'm not really sure. But We move now to Zechariah 9, verse 7. God says, I will remove their blood from their mouth, and their detestable things from between their teeth. They also will be a remnant for our God, and be like a clan in Judah, and Ekron like a Jebusite. Ekron, of course, is one of the interior cities of the Philistines, the five famous cities of the Philistines. Ekron was one of them. Yahweh says he's going to remove the blood from the mouth of the Philistines. He's going to remove the detestable things from between their teeth. That was the standard Jewish way of saying, these people are idolaters. They're breaking the law, because you couldn't eat blood under the law, of course. And detestable things would be things that weren't kosher, things that violated the dietary food laws. So these people would no longer be pagans. They would be subject to Yahweh's law. Then they also would be a remnant for our God. In other words, there will be a people who are under the jurisdiction of Yahweh and who have forgotten their pagan ways. There will be like a clan in Judah, because they will be occupied by Israel. And Ekron like a Jebusite, what does that mean? If you recall the story when David was king, David did not wipe out the Jebusites when he conquered Jerusalem from them. He merely incorporated them into Israel. And so the same thing would happen to the people of Ekron. They would be incorporated into Israel. Now, when did this happen? When did this remnant come to be, this remnant of Philistines? Here's some options. Option number one, the Maccabees did it. Benson says this remnant, this incorporating the Philistines like a clan into Judah, was fulfilled in the times of the Maccabees and also in the times of Alexander Janius, who subdued their principal cities, as Josephus relates, and made them part of the Jewish dominions, the inhabitants of several of which embraced the Jewish religion. Alexander Janius, or Janius, he ruled from 104 to 76. Well, that is a reasonable option. Option number two, the Ashdodites became a clan in Judah because of what Alexander the Great did. Now, Colin Delitzsch denied this, but let me read you what they say. Neither the remnant of the Phoenicians nor the other heathen, the Phoenicians would be Tyre and Sidon, nor the other heathen dwelling in the midst of Israel were converted to Jehovah through the calamities connected with Alexander's expedition. So Colin Delitzsch gives us option number three. It's not just Alexander that forced the Philistines to become a clan, a remnant in Judah, but the successors of Alexander, the Diadochi, and the Romans later on. Let me read you again from Colin Delitzsch. Fulfillment was continued throughout the calamities caused by the wars of succession. Those are the wars after Alexander died. The conflicts between the Egyptians, the Ptolemies, the Syrians, the Seleucids, and later on the Romans, who beat both the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, until it was completed, the fulfillment was completed by the fact that the heathen tribes within the boundaries of Israel gradually disappeared as separate tribes, and their remnants were received into the community of those who confessed Israel's God and his anointed. Jesus is who Colin Delitzsch is talking about there. And so that's true. The Philistines disappeared. They became a part of Israel. By the time of the Romans, they're gone. Colin Delitzsch is not finished, though. He gives us option number four. They give us option number four. The Philistines were made a remnant for Yahweh by becoming converted. And the Philistines stand for all the heathen world, not just the Philistines. Colin Delitzsch say this, but we must go a step further and say that the fulfillment has not yet reached its end, but is still going on and will until the kingdom of Christ shall attain that complete victory over the heathen world, which is foretold in Zechariah 9:8, which we're getting ready to go to in just a minute. So once again, we see how the commentators split on how some of these prophecies can be fulfilled as you go forward in time. But Zechariah is getting close to the time of Jesus. He's one of the very last prophets. And so it's logical that he's prophesying about the Maccabean and the Hasmonean intertestamental times, and also even beyond that to the times of Jesus the Messiah. And that's why there's so many quotations in Zechariah that are mentioned in New Testament history. We go now to Zechariah 9, verse 8. Yahweh says, I will set up camp at my house, that's his temple, against an army, against those who march back and forth, and no oppressor will march against them again, for now I have seen with my own eyes. Well, what is God looking at? He's looking at Alexander the Great marching back and forth. Alexander came down on his way to Egypt, roughly in 334, 333 maybe, By the time he got there, he goes down to Egypt, then he comes back and goes back through Palestine. Now, he could have done a lot of damage to the Jews, a lot of damage. He could have burnt the temple down. He had total power. However, the temple was supernaturally protected from Alexander as he went back and forth. I am going to read you from Josephus. This is an interesting story. Now, Alexander, when he had taken Gaza, made haste to go up to Jerusalem. And Jaddua, the high priest, when he heard that, was in agony and under terror, as not knowing how he should meet the Macedonians, since the king was displeased at his foregoing disobedience. He therefore ordained that the people should make supplications and should join with him in offering sacrifices to God, whom he besought to protect that nation and to deliver them from the perils that were coming upon them. Whereupon God warned him in a dream, which came upon him after he had offered sacrifice, that he should take courage, adorn the city, and open the gates. And the rest appeared in white garments, the other priest, but that he and the priest should meet the king in habits proper to their order, without the dread of any ill consequences, which the providence of God would prevent. Upon which, when he rose from his sleep, he greatly rejoiced, and declared to all the warning he had received from God. According to the dream, he acted entirely, and so waited for the coming of the king. So he has a dream, the high priest does, just open up the gates. Let Alexander the Great in, no problem. Continuing with Josephus, and when he, the high priest, Jaddua, when he understood that he was not far from the city, that Alexander was not far from the city, Jaddua went out in procession with the priest and the multitude of the citizens. The procession was venerable, and the manner of it different from that of other nations. It reached to a place called Sapha, which name, translated in Greek, signifies a prospect. For you have thence a prospect both of Jerusalem and of the temple. And when the Phoenicians and the Chaldeans that followed him, that followed Alexander, thought they should have liberty to plunder the city and torment the high priest to death, which the king's displeasure fairly promised them, the very reverse of it happened. For Alexander, when he saw the multitude at a distance in white garments, while the priest stood clothed with fine linen, and the high priest in purple and scarlet clothing, with his mitre on his head, having the golden plate on which the name of God was engraved, he, that's Alexander, approached by himself and adored that name, and first saluted the high priest. The Jews also did all together with one voice salute Alexander and encompass him about. Whereupon the kings of Syria and the rest were surprised at what Alexander had done, and supposed him to be disordered in his mind. The kings of Syria were those who were incorporated into Alexander's army. However, Parmenio, who was Alexander's second in command, alone went up to Alexander and asked him how it came to pass that when all others adored him, he should adore the high priest of the Jews. To whom Alexander replied, I did not adore him, the high priest, but that God who has honored him with that high priesthood. For I saw this very person in a dream, in this very habit, when I was at Dios in Macedonia, who, when I was considering with myself how I might obtain the dominion of Asia, exhorted me to make no delay, but boldly to pass over the sea thither, for that he would conduct my army, and would give me dominion over the Persians, whence it is that having seen no other in that habit, and now seeing this person in it, Jaddua the high priest, and remembering my vision and the exhortation which I had in my dream, I believe that I bring this army under divine conduct, and shall therewith conquer Darius, that's Darius the Third, and destroy the power of the Persians, and that all things will succeed according to what is in my own mind. And when he had said this to Parmenio, and had given the high priest his right hand, the priest ran along by him, and he came into the city, and when he went up into the temple, he offered sacrifice to God, according to the high priest's direction, and magnificently treated both the high priest and the priest. And when the book of Daniel was shown him, wherein Daniel declared that one of the Greeks should destroy the empire of the Persians, he supposed that himself was the person intended, which actually it was. He interpreted the Bible correctly. And as he was then, he dismissed the multitude for the present, but the next day he called them to him and bade them ask what favors they pleased of him. Whereupon the high priest desired that they might enjoy the laws of their forefathers and might pay no tribute on the seventh year. He granted all they desired, and when they entreated him that he would permit the Jews in Babylon and Media to enjoy their own laws also, he willingly promised to do hereafter what they desired, and when he said to the multitude that if any of them would enlist themselves in his army on this condition, that they should continue under the laws of their forefathers and live according to them, he was willing to take them with him many were ready to accompany him in his wars. This is in Josephus, not the Jewish War, but the Antiquities. Now that's quite an amazing story. Let's read Zechariah 9:8 again. I will set up camp at my house against an army. So God is going to guard his temple against an army, Alexander's army. That army marched back and forth. That's exactly what Alexander did. He went through Israel twice. No oppressor will march against them again. In other words, Alexander's not going to oppress them and march against the temple at Jerusalem. For now I have seen with my own eyes, God has looked down and protected. He gave two dreams, one to Alexander and one to Jaddua the high priest. The two dreams jibed and coincided, and God worked a miracle without violating their free will. Now verse 8 says that no oppressor will march against them again. As a matter of historical fact, no further oppressors came against the Jews as a result of Alexander's campaign. In fact, the successor, one of the major successors of Alexander, Ptolemy Lagus, who became Ptolemy the First Soter of Egypt, ruled 305/304 to 282, he treated the Jews with favor. He initiated the translation of the Hebrew scriptures into the Greek, called the Septuagint, which of course is quoted all the time in the New Testament, and which we still today use. So Zechariah's prophecy was precisely fulfilled. We move now to Zechariah 9:9. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout in triumph, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. He is just and endowed with salvation, humble and mounted on a donkey, even on a colt, the foal of a donkey. Well, now, of course, we're quite familiar with this verse. This is Jesus on Palm Sunday coming into Jerusalem. So this is an easy verse to interpret, an easy verse to know when it was fulfilled. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Daughter means the population of Zion. Zion can be a symbol for Jerusalem or for Judah or for northern Israel or for the whole nation of Israel. In the New Testament, it's the symbol of the church. Here, by parallelism, we can see it's Jerusalem. O daughter of Zion, O daughter of Jerusalem, mentioned in the same sentence. So rejoice, people of Jerusalem, because your king is coming to you. That's exactly what Jesus did. Now, we might ask a question. Why would a messianic prophecy be inserted right here in the middle of prophecies against nations, against Tyre, Sidon, Ashdod? Well, one of my commentators, I didn't write down which one, but he said that this could be in order to warn the Jews from following after Alexander, because Alexander, as you know from what I just read, was considered to be a very big man, a very important man, and the Jews were following after him and appreciated his protection. He was a remarkable character who had been very kind to the Jews, and the Jews might very well have decided to make Alexander their king. He was king over everybody else as he was conquering everybody. But Zechariah is saying, nope, your king is going to be coming in to the city humble, mounted on a donkey, a colt. The foal of a donkey is even more humble than a donkey. I've heard some people say that that really was not a symbol of humility because they didn't use horses in Israel, that if you rode on a donkey, that would be a king riding on a donkey, and that would not show humility. But the colt, that is pretty humble. Now, of course, this was fulfilled by Jesus in Matthew 21:5, which reads this way, tell daughter Zion, tell the population of Jerusalem, in other words, tell them, look, your king is coming to you, gentle and mounted on a donkey, even on a colt, the foal of a beast of burden. That's a direct quote from Zechariah, an example of all the New Testament quotations of our prophet Zechariah. We move now to Zechariah 9:10. Yahweh continues, and I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the horse from Jerusalem, and the bow of war will be cut off. And he will speak peace to the nations, and his dominion will be from sea to sea, and from the river to the ends of the earth. Well, I'm going to explain this first, but let me just give you an overview of it. This is the Messiah's rule, ruling all over the earth, his church spreading all over the world. And 2,000 years later, actually 2,500 years later, that's where we are now. Jesus' church is all over the world. At the beginning of the verse, verse 10, Yahweh says, I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim. A chariot, of course, is an instrument of war. Ephraim is northern Israel, and the horse from Jerusalem, that's southern Israel. And so that means from all of Israel, there will be no more instruments of war. Why? Because the new Israel is a nation of peace. The church will not need weapons of physical warfare to conquer, but spiritual weapons instead. The bow of war will be cut off. A bow is another weapon of war. Cut off, it's not going to be used anymore. And he, that's the Messiah, Jesus, who comes into Jerusalem humbly, riding on the colt of a donkey, he, Jesus, will speak peace to the nations. Oh, that's Jesus spreading the word of God all through the world. As Fred Miller, the contemporary commentator, says, this can only be fulfilled after the coming of the Messiah. It can't be talking about the Golden Age, which was between 458 and 168 before the Maccabeans. The rest of the chapter does deal with the Golden Age, according to Miller, but this is a messianic parenthesis. In other words, it's obviously speaking about Jesus. Now, Guzik, the futurist dispensationalist, says it's the millennium, despite the fact that the previous verse, verse 9, is obviously not the millennium. It was in AD 30 when Jesus came into Jerusalem. But you know how futurists are. They got to shoehorn everything into the millennium so that the church can be a zero, a gap, a parenthesis, a vacuum, a nothing burger. No, this is talking about the spread of the church from sea to sea. His dominion will be from sea to sea, verse 10 says. Now, these words are taken from King David, as Joseph Benson points out. We read in Psalms 72, verse 8, may he rule from sea to sea and from the Euphrates to the ends of the earth. It's pretty much a direct quote. What does sea to sea mean? Well, it can mean the Mediterranean to the Red Sea. More probably, it can mean Mediterranean to the Euphrates, which in effect means the whole earth, because as Benson says, and Barnes believes, but Benson says this, the preachers of his gospel shall carry it from one country to another, from one island and continent to another, till the remotest parts of the earth are enlightened and reduced by it to the obedience of the faith and the practice of love and holiness. You could just take from sea to sea as just a general reference to everywhere in the world. I'm not really sure what Zechariah meant, but the ultimate intent is obvious. The gospel is going everywhere, from the river, that's the Euphrates River, to the ends of the earth. Well, there you go. All over the earth, the gospel is going to spread. We go now to Zechariah 9, verse 11 and verse 12. Yahweh continues, as for you also, because of the blood of my covenant with you, Yahweh is still speaking to the Israelites, because of the blood of my covenant with you, I have set your prisoners free from the waterless pit. Return to the stronghold, O prisoners who have this hope. This very day I am declaring that I will restore double to you. Now the blood of my covenant which Yahweh has with the Israelites, there's a couple of options that this might refer to. It could refer to the blood of the covenant which was sealed at Mount Sinai, as Barnes believes. We read that in Exodus 24:6-8. Moses took half the blood and set it in the basins, the other half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. He then took the covenant scroll and read it aloud to the people. They responded, we will do and obey everything that the Lord has commanded. Moses took the blood, sprinkled it on the people, and said, this is the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you concerning all these words. Blood of the covenant. It's the same phraseology. The pulpit commentator says that this blood of the Sinai covenant was used as a token of the blood of Jesus, in other words, a type. That's option number two. Option number three is that Yahweh is referring directly to the blood of Jesus. The blood of my covenant with you Israelites, is ultimately fulfilled with the new Israelites, the new children of Abraham, the church, which includes Gentiles as well as Jews. The context really does sound like the new covenant, because remember we read in verse 9 about Jesus coming into Jerusalem on the colt of a donkey. That's our context. I also said verse 10 was the same thing, the spread of the gospel over the whole world. And so it does sound like the blood of the covenant might be referring to Jesus' blood. Well, we can just split the difference and say he's referring to both. The blood of the covenant at Mount Sinai, which is a type of the blood of Jesus the Messiah. Now, the blood of the covenant frees the Israelites from the waterless pit. A pit with no water means that you don't have any drinking water if you're captive in there, so that's a bad business, a waterless pit. Now, what is this pit? Fred Miller says it's the pit of hell. Joseph Benson says as an option is Egypt, when the Israelites were enslaved in Egypt. Benson and Poole both affirm that the pit is Babylon, and Benson says so most interpreters understand the passage. Colin Delitzsch says it's an allusion to Joseph in his pit before he got sold into slavery to Egypt. Well, I'll just go with the majority here. This is Babylon. I have set your prisoners free from Babylon, the waterless pit, because I freed the exiles by the decree of Cyrus in 539, and the exiles came back from Babylon circa 538, and came back to Jerusalem. Verse 12, return to the stronghold. That would be going back to Jerusalem. Here's some options on stronghold. Mount Zion in Jerusalem, as the Cambridge commentary suggests, as an option. Another option is, suggested by Cambridge, that the stronghold is a rocky fastness in Palestine to which former Babylonian prisoners fled. So that's basically the same option. Jerusalem is another option by Matthew Poole in the pulpit commentary. Poole suggests it and pulpit affirms it. Barnes says the stronghold is God. Lee Smith says it's Jesus, the Messiah. Benson says it's the New Covenant Church. Well, here we have the same situation. Returning back to Jerusalem is a type of returning to the stronghold of Jesus. O prisoners who have the hope in the New Covenant, returning to the stronghold means that the prisoners who were enslaved to sin then go to Jesus for their salvation. But of course it could apply to the Jews who had returned from Babylon also. I've got no problem with that. One is a type of the other. At the end of verse 12, Yahweh says, this very day I am declaring that I will restore double to you. Now, here are some options as to what that might mean. Joseph Benson says that the fullness of the New Testament is more than the Old Testament. Benson says, these spiritual blessings and heavenly things were double to what they had ever enjoyed in their most prosperous state. Fred Miller says that a double portion of the inheritance belongs to the firstborn, and Christians are the firstborn. We read in Hebrews 12:23, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven. So the church has the right of inheritance, and so that's why they have a double portion. Their spiritual inheritance is greater than the inheritance of the land that the Jews had. Option number two as to what this restoring double might mean, the golden age between Ezra and Antiochus Epiphanes IV, 458 to 168, that golden age is better than the age before the destruction of Jerusalem in 586. Well, it was. Then you would have to take that blood of the covenant, which was mentioned in verse 11 as referring to the Old Testament sacrifices. Well, that's a reasonable option. I don't really think it's true. I like the option that says it's the New Testament privileges and inheritance that's double what the Jews had in the Old Testament. The Old Testament inheritance was physical. The New Testament inheritance is spiritual. And of course, option number three as to what this double restoration is, the millennium in the future. Well, you know what I think about that. Colin Delitzsch says that the double restoration is a double measure of glory in place of the sufferings they had, which is kind of a general statement. We're going to take it that the fullness of the New Testament is double that of the Old Testament. I think that's reasonable, and it fits right in with the fulfillment of verses 9, 10, 11, and 12 with the first coming of Jesus. We move now to Zechariah 9, verse 13. Yahweh continues, for I will bend Judah as my bow, I will fill the bow with Ephraim, and I will stir up your sons, O Zion, against your sons, O Greece, and I will make you like a warrior's sword. Now this is somewhat of a strange metaphor. God takes Judah, that's the bow. Now bow's got to have an arrow, so he takes northern Israel as the arrow. Ephraim stands for northern Israel. So basically he's saying that all of Israel is going to be a military weapon. Well, who are they going to fight against? Yahweh says, I will stir up your sons against the sons of Greece. Well, that's Alexander the Great, who came from Macedon, which is right north of Greece. So, verse 13 is clearly referring to the Maccabean War against the Seleucids, which was fought between 167 during the times of Antiochus Epiphanes IV, the Seleucid emperor who came up from Egypt in 168. So from 167 to 160, you've got the Maccabean Revolt, and that's what's being talked about here in verse 13. So Zechariah predicted that. Now, this is so clear that I have got six commentators who immediately say that this is what it refers to. No hemming, no hawing, no disagreement. Barnes, Benson, Cambridge, Colin Delitzsch, Poole, and Pulpit all say it's the Maccabean War. I love it when we have unanimity. However, we have Guzik, my dear dispensationalist futurist commentator, who says that this verse is only partially fulfilled in the Maccabean War. There is a future fulfillment yet to come. Now, when that is, who knows? Futurists love to speculate, and they love to be wrong, too, because they always are. No, this is referring to the Maccabean War. End of story, in my humble opinion. We move now to Zechariah chapter 9, verses 14 through 16. Then the Lord will appear over them, and that would be the Maccabean Jews fighting the Seleucid Greeks. Then the Lord will appear over them, and his arrow will fly like lightning. The Lord God will sound the trumpet, advance with the southern storms. The Lord of hosts will defend them. They will consume and conquer with sling stones. They will drink and be rowdy as if with wine. They will be as full as the sprinkling basin, like those at the corners of the altar. The Lord their God will save them on that day as the flock of his people, for they are like jewels on a crown, sparkling over his land. Fred Miller says of this fight between the Maccabeans and the Seleucids, if you can compare the unlimited resources of the Seleucid Greek Empire with the ragtag Jewish guerrilla forces, then you would be assured that there was no way that Israel or Judah could have defeated many Greek armies in many battles with untrained Levites and broken loose to maintain an independent Jewish state for 100 years in the shadow of Antioch. Antioch is the capital of the Seleucids. Without the special protection of the God who favored them as his special people. Yes, it's quite a great story. That's why people love the stories of the Maccabeans, how the outnumbered and outgunned Israelites managed to set up an independent kingdom there for a while before the Romans took them over. In verse 14, Yahweh says his arrow will fly like lightning. He referred to Ephraim as his arrow in verse 13. Maybe that's what he's talking about here, or maybe he's just talking about arrows in general. The point is God's going to be fighting for these Jews. He will sound the trumpet. A trumpet is blasted when armies are getting ready to move. He will advance with the southern storms. He'll come like a thunderstorm on the Seleucids. The Lord of hosts will defend the Maccabees. The Maccabees will consume and conquer with sling stones. They will drink and be rowdy. That means they won, and so they get drunk at their celebration after the battle, which seems a little bit unspiritual. Getting rowdy as if with wine, because that's what drunk people do. They get rowdy. There's a little bit of dissonance there for me. God appears with the Maccabees and fights for them, and then they get drunk as a result. And it doesn't seem like Zechariah or Yahweh is condemning them in any way when he says this. They will be as full as the sprinkling basin. Now, of course, the priest, when they sacrificed animals, they would collect the blood from the animal in a basin, and then they would carry that basin around to sprinkle the corners of the altar in the Levitical rituals. The question is how are the Maccabees to be full? Full of the blood of their enemies or full of wine? Well, it depends on how we translate the end of verse 15. The Holman Christian Study Bible has at the corners of the altar, they will be as full as the sprinkling basin, like those sprinkling basins at the corners of the altar. And I guess what that would mean is the sprinkling basin would be full of blood when it's carried to the corner of the altar by the priest. That's one way of translating it, but there are a lot of other ways, so let's run through some possibilities. The American Standard Version says they shall be filled like bowls, like the corners of the altar. What does that mean? Bible and Basic English says they will take their blood for drink like wine. They will be full like the sides of the altar. Again, a problematic translation in my humble opinion, especially for people who speak English as a second language. I speak English as a first language, and I'm not really sure what is meant by that. Darby says, they shall be filled like a bowl, like the corners of the altar. God's word says, they shall be filled like a sacrificial bowl used for sprinkling the corners of the altar. That one makes a lot of sense to me, but used for sprinkling is put in brackets. That's not in the original text. Translator's interpretation. Holman Christian Study Bible, as I just said, they will be full as the sprinkling basin like those at the corners of the altar. King James says they shall be filled like bowls and as the corners of the altar. The New American Bible says they shall drink blood like wine till they are filled with it like libation bowls like the corners of the altar. The New American Standard Bible says, and they will be filled like a sacrificial basin, drenched like the corners of the altar. And the Young's Literal Translation says they have been full as a bowl, as corners of an altar. You can see from the literal translation there's a lot to work with there. It's kind of sparse. The Hebrew is. Well, from all of that, I have induced four options. Option number one, the Israelites will be full of wine, in other words, drenched, like libation bowls are full of blood. Option number two, Israelites will be full of blood, like libation bowls are full of blood. That would mean the blood of their enemies. Metaphorically speaking, they wouldn't be literally drinking blood, but they could have if they had wanted to, because they had taken so much blood. Option number three, the Israelites would be full of wine, in other words, drenched with wine, like the corners of the altar are drenched in blood. Option number four, Israelites will be full of blood, like the corners of the altar are drenched in blood. So either the libation bowls are full of blood, or the corners of the altar are drenched in blood, and the Israelites are either drinking wine or they're drinking blood. Well, it doesn't really matter. The point is the Israelites won. The Maccabees won. Verse 16, the Lord their God will save the Maccabees like a flock. He's the shepherd, they're the flock. For the Maccabees are like jewels in a crown, sparkling over his land. That metaphor is obvious, beautiful. We go now to Zechariah 9, verse 17, and we will finish this chapter. Yahweh continues, for what comeliness and beauty will be theirs. Grain will make the young men flourish, and new wine the virgins. Lots of luxuriant grain, new wine. The young people of the land will flourish and be happy and be beautiful and comely. When is this? Well, Guzik. He says it's going to be the millennium. No, it will not be the millennium in my humble opinion. The Maccabean Age is option number two. That makes a lot of sense because we just finished talking about the Maccabees. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says this refers to the New Covenant Age of Jesus the Messiah. Well, I don't have any problem with saying that. It's the Maccabeans who are going to be eating grain and drinking new wine, but that time of prosperity under the Maccabeans is a mere type of what is going to be fulfilled in the times of the New Covenant Age of Jesus Christ. And on that very happy note, we are finished with Zechariah 9. We are prepared to go to Zechariah 10 in our next audio, which I will entitle Restoration for Judah and Israel. Some more good news. Hope you stay tuned with me for that discussion, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.